The K-Pop Podcast is sponsored by T. Rowe Price. Are you looking to learn a thing or two about getting your finances in order, saving, and investing? Check out The Confident Wallet, a personal finance podcast series by T. Rowe Price and the Washington Post Brand Studio. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
In honor of Black History Month, all February, this podcast will be dedicated to featuring African Americans whose voices and perspectives you need to hear. We'll have a new episode every Tuesday, but if you're a fan of the podcast, you know we feature prominent Black voices all year long. So we've chosen a few older episodes to republish every Thursday to reacquaint you with some of them. This week, Dr. Carla Hayden, the first African American and first woman to lead the Library of Congress. Dr. Hayden, thank you very much for doing this, for having us here.
I think I told you before when we were at a wonderful museum setting that the Library of Congress is one of the best kept secrets, but we don't want to be a secret.
Right, and we're going to get to the part that's not a secret in a minute, but the reason why I wanted to come here and talk to you and get a look around this place is that it's palpable even just right now that you love your job. And not just being Librarian of Congress, but being a librarian. How did that happen? How did you get this love of books and libraries and research and history?
I'm the product of two classically trained musicians. And my earliest memories are in being in a practice room, my dad on the violin, my mom at the piano, and them putting me under the piano with toys and then books. And as I was listening to music, I was associating that with text. And by the time I was 12, though, it was clear that I didn't have the talent that they had.
The musical talent.
Not a bit. And they didn't pressure me, but we all agreed that where they would look at notes and be able to hear music, I could look at text and hear words. And later I found out there's a profession that allows you to combine your love of reading and books with helping other people.
So then, how do you become a librarian? And certainly, how do you rise up to the ranks to being, what, the most important librarian in the world?
What has happened to me is I call myself an accidental librarian. I didn't know you could go and get a master's degree in library science. I didn't know about the profession. I would actually go into a library, a central library, between job interviews after I graduated from undergrad. Mm-hmm. And I was there, and one of my fellow graduate colleagues said, "Hey, are you for those library jobs? They're hiring anybody with any degree."
Anybody.
Anybody with a degree. Well, libraries still do that. They hire people with undergraduate degrees. Mm-hmm. But then I was assigned to a young lady that was doing wonderful things in a storefront library, and she was going to graduate library school. And that's when I said, oh, wow. There is a path that can combine some of the things that I really loved.
So when I was growing up, libraries were places where you were quiet. That's not the case anymore, is it?
In fact, now libraries are creating quiet spaces and quiet rooms.
Like a quiet car in a train?
In a train, because there's so much activity. You have coffee shops and you have all types of things going on. There's some libraries that have stores, like a museum shop. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of activity going on, so people are saying, I need a place where I can study and just be quiet for a minute. And so libraries are developing quiet spaces now.
Well, I mean, it must be a challenge now in this digital age when, like for me, I can do all the research I need right from my desk. I can type into Google or whatever and get all the information I want. But, okay, so you're giving me that look.
I'm giving you a look because a lot of the things that you are retrieving online have been put online by libraries like the Library of Congress. So we are working together with technology companies and search engines to make sure that these collections are available online. The Library of Congress just put the papers of Sigmund Freud online and Rosa Parks, her collection, and three presidents We have the papers of 23 presidents from George Washington all the way to Coolidge. And so we just put up Milmore, Fremore. Okay, you see, I didn't
Millard,
get that
Millard
one right.
Fillmore?
We want him to be better known. I have to say, he's not here. But we're working on Woodrow Wilson mm-hmm. and Teddy Roosevelt. So you'll have all of that.
So do you have an app?
Not yet. And we will be announcing it very shortly. We do have an app already for our services for the blind and physically handicapped.
Oh.
We have a national service, and they can download books and do things through the app. And also for our Veterans History Project. And that one we're really excited about because veterans can record their own oral histories and submit them for posterity and for sharing. So that project is really going on. We have about 150,000 oral histories already.
So there's a lot of talk about so-called alternative facts and fake news and people not trusting information that they see and information that they read. I would just love your perspective on the impact of all of that as a librarian, because you deal in books and facts and knowledge, and where we are as a country seems to be anti that.
I must tell you, and when I mentioned my library colleagues or just, yay, Library of Congress, another thing that we're very energized about is the fact that people are thinking and talking about something that's a bedrock of our profession, information literacy. How do you know that the sources are authoritative, sources that you can trust, especially about health information? So that's a major part of librarianship, is making sure that the information is credible, especially information about facts. And so we are talking about information literacy even more, that just like you have internet safety and you're teaching young people about being safe on the internet, we're also really involved with letting young people know about sources online as well.
So we're here at the Library of Congress, surrounded by everything, it seems. Talk about some of the collections that are here that people might not know are here.
And I'm smiling because you have 164 million items, collections that range from the largest gathering of comic books in the world to Jackie Robinson's papers and the correspondence with Branch Rickey, who was that famous scout, and his scouting papers that assess Hank Aaron, where he says, I think he has a future. Ernie Banks, Sandy Kovacs, to actual draft of the Declaration of Independence in Thomas Jefferson's hand, with annotations by John Adams and Benjamin Franklin. And you can see where they crossed out and took out sections, especially the section on slavery, because they knew that that would be pretty controversial and they might not get that declaration passed.
You're the first woman,
yes,
Librarian of Congress. You're also the first African-American Librarian of Congress. Do you feel the weight of history on your shoulders when you walk into this building? Well, actually, there are three buildings. When you walk into the buildings of the Library of Congress?
I mentioned my library colleagues, and there is much joy in Mudville in the library world because of the fact that I'm a female in a female-dominated profession,
right,
where at least 85 to 90% of the workforce is female. And the management of libraries might not reflect that fact. And the part about being an African-American is very humbling because I'm from a race that had been forbidden to learn how to read. And I looked up a lot of those laws when I was preparing my swearing-in comments, and they were pretty severe. I knew that, but to just see them in print, amputation, finger by finger, each time that you were caught trying to learn to read, the number of lashes that you'll get. And so to be an African-American who is responsible for the world's largest library was the part that made me realize that this was a journey that I was a part of and proud to be part of.
How important is it to you to be a symbol for not just a race of people, our people, but for little kids who might look at you and say, you know, I never thought that I could be the Librarian of Congress or be a librarian, and yet here's this fabulous lady who's got this fantastic job.
And it's the fantastic job that is the most exciting in terms of young people, because when I talk about the cool things that the Library of Congress has, from the baseball cards to all of these wonderful photographs and prints and all of these treasures, their eyes light up and they are interested in history. And it's like, you mean being a librarian can be fun and be cool? And you don't, and the greatest compliment is always, you don't look like a librarian. And I know what they mean. And so you have young people also who are very interested in technology. And when you talk about making your website more user-friendly or a library app and things like that, and how can you use technology to connect people to resources, that also gets young people involved. Mm-hmm. And then there's the aspect of people of different backgrounds.
So why shouldn't I think of you as a museum director?
Actually, that would be somewhat accurate, because the Library of Congress has aspects of a public library, a college library, a museum, because of the actual artifacts, the contents of Abraham Lincoln's pockets the night he was assassinated. That's museum quality item that you would see on display. And so I had experience working at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. And so I've had the museum experience, I've had library experience, I've taught library science. So this is really a combination of all of those worlds.
Dr. Carla Hayden, 14th Librarian of Congress, thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
This episode of Cape Up is sponsored by MeUndies. You want to look good in your underwear and be comfortable, right? But the perfect balance is hard to find. Don't sacrifice style or comfort. Check out MeUndies. Right now, it's National Underwear Month, and you can try MeUndies risk-free. MeUndies are made from Lensing Micromodal, a fabric 3 times softer than cotton, cut for comfort and style. That's what makes them the world's most comfortable underwear. Try them today. There's no risk. If you don't love your MeUndies, they're free. Now through August 31st, get 20% off your first pair, plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/CapeUp. That's MeUndies.com/CapeUp.
After our interview, Dr. Hayden brought us to a conference room near her office where some really cool items from the Library of Congress were laid out. Now, we have a video of this on Facebook, so go check that out. But first, Dr. Hayden told us how a particularly interesting item was found in 1975.
The legend goes that the new Librarian of Congress moved into the office, and there was a door that had a vault. It was like a false door.
What year are we talking about?
You're talking about 1953 or so. 50s. Right? And the librarian goes in, there's this false door, there's a bank vault there, but nobody knows the combination. Legend continues that the gentleman who was, let's say, incarcerated for being very expert at opening these types of things was given a small pardon to come and help open the vault. And he did. And inside there was just one item. And it was this one black box. And in the box, when they opened it, was a note saying that through a gift from Abraham Lincoln's granddaughter, these were the contents of his pocket the night he was assassinated.
I mean, come on.
These are the things that were in his pocket. And it's remarkable because there's something very humanizing about seeing the button that had been put in his pocket. Think about losing a button, and what's the first thing you do? You
put it in your pocket. I've got one in my pocket right now.
He had a Confederate note bill. He had visited the South a couple of weeks before the assassination and probably kept that bill, $5 bill, as a kind of memento or just something to think about.
And isn't that why? I mean, he's got a Confederate $5 bill,
yes.
And today he's on our $5
right,
bill.
Right. A pocket knife, a wallet that's very nice looking when you think about it, for notes and currency and that.
Currency was really small back then.
Yes, it was. And you folded it up, but you could see. Two pairs of spectacles, glasses, one that's a little more traditional. And then one that folds up into a small case. And
which you have one of those.
I have
one. You've got your little
I have it. It's very similar. So the synergies are just something. But that was that type of case. And then a wonderful lens cleanser.
For your eyeglasses. Which I wish they made these now. Because
now,
I would have one in my pocket too.
And then, of course, this handkerchief with a Lincoln.
Monogram.
These were the things. And then also, though, clippings that talked about his presidency. About six articles. And a few of them were complimentary and a few of them weren't. And he had those folded up and was carrying them in his pocket.
In his pocket. Or as TJ, our producer, said, it's sort of like you having your phone and having your bookmarks open. And seeing all the kind of nasty things people say
and
about
a few
you
good ones too.
Online.
But to think that these things were in his pocket that night, and the Library of Congress had those.
I mean, this is incredible. This is the closest any of us will ever come to Abraham Lincoln
in that sense. And I have to tell you, as the 14th Librarian of Congress, I looked through every nook and cranny of the new office that I got in, hoping to discover something.
Then Dr. Hayden yielded her time to Senior Reference Librarian Eric Frazier, and the first thing he showed us was Thomas Jefferson's Quran.
This is a special Quran. This came to us through the Thomas Jefferson sale in 1815. And this Quran was in his collection, in his religion collection, down at Monticello. After the library burned in 1815, this is part of that sale that essentially reconstituted the Library of Congress.
Right, that's something I didn't know before, that the Library of Congress has been burned down twice.
Yes.
The first time completely burned down, and Thomas Jefferson sold his entire collection to the Library of Congress, and then half the collection was incinerated at that point.
That's correct. In 1850, there was another fire, and in fact, maybe about half of the collection of the Library of Congress, three quarters of the collection of Thomas Jefferson's initial 1815 sale was actually burned in that fire as well. So we're actually in the process of rebuilding his initial sale to the Library of Congress.
How do you rebuild that kind of collection?
Sure. Thankfully, we still have a few catalogs of the collection that was sold to the Library of Congress. So we have the handwritten catalog saying which particular books came to the library. And so through that, we're rebuilding the collection.
Then Eric Frazier showed us a book written by Copernicus in 1543.
This is one of the first times, and one of the more significant first times, that the sun is actually portrayed in the center of our solar system. And so we have actually the diagram. We're opened up to the diagram right here. Now, this is in contrary to what the Catholic Church was teaching at the time. And so it was heretical. It was an arguably difficult book to publish, and so Copernicus actually—it's arguable as to whether he he had it published a few days before or a few days after he died. He made sure he wasn't
that's
going
why
to
I
be
love
around.
It.
Yeah, for the consequences that fell. He left that to Galileo, who eventually spent a few of his years in prison and defending Copernicus's theories.
Speaking of Galileo, he wrote Starry Messenger in 1610, and the edition we were shown contains what Dr. Hayden, Eric Fraser, and many others believe are the very visible fingerprints of Galileo.
This happens to be a piece by Galileo right here. This is what's called Sidereus Nuncius. This is 1610. This is Galileo looking at the moon for the first time through a telescope, and he actually draws diagrams, and it's this very special piece.
And there is another legend. Do you see faint fingerprints here? Eric can tell you that but there is speculation that these are the fingerprints of Galileo.
We'd like to believe that.
And there's reason to believe it, Eric.
Okay.
Mainly because of where the type of print that it is, the copy that he could have picked up.
This is actually very true. So this is actually, this came to us in this binding. This binding is what's called a printer's binding. And essentially before the year 1800, books would come, if I may, books would come in this format. You would essentially buy the text block, but you wouldn't necessarily buy the covers to the book. And so what happens is you take that text block to a binder, and the binder would put whatever type of cover you could afford or want for that book. And so in order to keep the pages and the text block clean, they would printers would often put on these printer's papers. And so this is actually printer's papers. It never actually made it to the binder. And that's why you also see this ragged edge. This is what's called a deckled edge. And the deckled edge is indicative of paper that hasn't yet been cut down to fit a particular binding.
Like this one.
That's exactly right.
And with the gold.
Yeah. This happens to have a gilt fore edge as well.
So the thought is that he was seeing early printings of the book, and he picked it up, and that might be his finger.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just going to have a moment here, because the idea that we're looking at potentially, maybe, the fingerprints of Galileo is just a little mind-blowing.
Next up, the very colorful Apocalypse of St. John.
This book was actually partially published, partially written, and partially created in 1465.
With the colors jumping out of you. 1465, it's just as vivid as it was.
Yeah.
Sure. And so this book is it's essentially created in 1465 because it's what's called a Sammelband, and it's the Apocalypse of St. John is what we call this book. We call it that because the most significant part of the book is at the very end, and it's actually a block book. A block book was more of a pressing or a stamped book. And so what we're looking at right now is a book that is rather a page that is half text and then half illustration. And it was done that way so that it would be this didactic, colorful book and lesson for those who wanted to see it, whether they be literate or not. Now, it's true, the colors have held up very, very well for the last 400 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Now, one of the ways that you can always tell a block book, and if you come across one, well, give me a call and we can work it out from there.
Okay? Right.
They're very, very valuable, very, very scarce, these books are. And what ends up happening is, in order to create a block book, you essentially carve into wood the text and the images. So this is all one, the page, the whole page is all one carving. Then it's inked, and then the page is actually put down onto the carving, mm-hmm. and the back is rubbed. And so one of the ways you can always tell a black book is that the opposite side of the illustration is always blank because they had to rub this. And in doing so, if you try to turn it over and do the same on the back, you'd actually ruin what you've just created. And so this is a very, very special book.
And finally, Poems on Various Subjects, a book of poems by Phyllis Wheatley, the first African-American female poet to ever be published.
Phyllis Wheatley, actually, Phyllis was named after the ship that actually brought her from Africa to Boston, I'm sorry to say. She was sold to the Wheatley family, and she was educated within the family, showed great aptitude, and as soon as they saw this, they actually took her off of duties within the house, so to speak, and had her on full-time education. She tried to publish her book of poems here in America, but being a slave, there wasn't a printer in America that was going to print her work. She went with the Wheatley son to London, or actually England, took a small tour around England, actually met with a benefactor and was able to publish in London. Now, she wasn't able to publish in London automatically or immediately. Bell, the publisher, also asked for proof that she had written these pieces. And so she had to go through some interviews and quite a bit of trials and tribulations, so to speak, in order to even be published in London.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ. And tune in next week when we get back into serious policy. This time, we're talking about the debt ceiling, and we're going to do it in plain English.
Hi, I'm Mike Rosenwald, a reporter here at The Washington Post. I'm hosting a new daily podcast called Retropod. It's a show about the past rediscovered. Every weekday morning, we'll explore some of history's most dramatic moments. I'll introduce you to colorful characters from our past, forgotten heroes, overlooked villains, dreamers, explorers, world changers. Check it out on your Amazon Echo, Google Home, or your favorite podcast player. For instructions on how to listen, visit washingtonpost.com/retropod.
The Washington
Post.
Washington Post.